Anyway, results of the Utah Legislative Auditor General's report auditing the Utah Department of Transportation's process of funding and construction the sound wall there on Interstate 80 near Jeremy Ranch were released last week. The report finds that UDOT did follow its internal policy, as well as state and federal statutes, throughout the process of designing and constructing the noise wall. A representative of the group, Citizens Against the Wall, Tom Farkas, who fought this wall throughout, once again disappointed by those findings. He joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie.
So maybe you can just recap for us. What were the findings of that audit? Basically, what we had heard from UDOT itself months before that?
Yes and no. The results of the audit were disappointing to us because we really felt that we had made significant and correct allegations that UDOT was in violation of their policy and federal guidelines. Unfortunately, the legislative auditors didn't see it that way. However, they did point out that there needed to be a number of changes in UDOT's policy moving forward. One of the allegations that we made was that UDOT built a berm wall. In the UDOT noise policy, there is no provision for a berm wall. There is only a provision for a wall as the definition of a noise barrier. The auditors didn't seem to find that since UDOT built something that wasn't in their policy, they didn't feel for some reason that it wasn't a violation. But their recommendation was they should add the definition of a berm wall into their policy. Another issue that we raised was that they hadn't properly done the cost calculations for the berm wall. We maintain that they were maybe barely $12,000 on the cost effective side, but only doing that because they had totally ignored the cost of the berm itself. Again, if they didn't meet the cost criteria in our mind, that would be a violation. The auditor said, however, that since there was no provision for a berm wall in the policy, that it was justified that they didn't include the cost of the berm. However, they did recommend that UDOT include in the future the cost of everything involved in order to build a noise barrier. And if their definition includes a berm wall, then they have to include the cost of the berm. The final item, though, is a bit trickier and a little bit more complicated, and one that we still feel that is not properly addressed. UDOT, in order to justify the cost of both the wall and the berm, conceived of a concept called mixed land uses and combined cost criteria. There is no language for mixed land uses or combined cost criteria in either UDOT noise policy or in federal guidelines. Now, in addition, the calculations of that kind of seem to vary all over the place. In May of 2017, when UDOT issued their first report on the 18-foot high wall, they maintained that the allowable cost criteria was $1,236,000. They claimed that they met that cost criteria, but in fact they didn't, because they neglected or ignored to include the cost of items that were critical to safety. Then, instead of acknowledging that they didn't meet their cost criteria, they just moved on and came up with another proposal for the berm wall, which we already discussed wasn't in their policy. For the berm wall, somehow they came up with a maximum allowable cost of $1,154,280. They claim that the berm wall met that cost criteria, but again, since they neglected to include the cost of the berm, when that is added in, they did not meet that cost criteria. Now, in the auditor's report, we've got a whole new set of cost criteria, which has never been published by UDOT or made public prior to the auditor's report. Now they're saying that the allowable cost criteria is $1,872,000 for the wall or $1,902,000 for the berm wall. And they come to those conclusions because in the first example of the wall where they, in the May report, the length of the land use that was identified as recreational land use, UDOT said was 1,600 feet. When they did the berm wall, the report in October of 2017, they said the length of the land use for the recreational area was 2,373 feet. Now in the auditor's report, UDOT claims that the length of the recreational area is now 3,200 feet. Essentially, they are double dipping into their cost criteria in order to justify the wall. What they're saying is they'll take the full length, even though the residential area doesn't span that far, they'll take that full length, use the residential cost criteria for the allowable, then they use the number of residences with their cost factor. If, ironically, the Jeremy Ranch Golf Course clubhouse were actually located on top of the driving range instead of on the other side of Jeremy Ranch Road, according to UDOT's simple method of coming up with cost criteria, they would actually triple the cost criteria. They would get another $360 per linear foot for another 3,200 feet because an office or a bar restaurant is another land use category that has the same criteria as recreational. If they had done that, or if that's where the golf course office was located, we could be facing a wall at Jeremy Ranch that is 36 feet high instead of what we actually have now. The biggest problem, though, is with the first two issues that the auditors recommended, they said, we would like UDOT to change their policy to ensure that they are consistent with federal regulations, 23 CFR 772. Then they make a recommendation at the end of all this maximum allowable cost criteria that says they should include language in their policy that shows how the combined cost factor and the mixed land use would be dealt with. Again, they tell them to be sure to be consistent with federal guidelines. There is no language in the federal guidelines that addresses mixed land uses nor combined cost criteria. So it's essentially an impossible task for UDOT to do, to put that language in their policy and be consistent with federal guidelines.
Well, you've got to feel pretty good. I mean, that some of your concerns were validated then.
Leslie, the only thing I feel good about now is that it's over and I can stop banging my head against the wall.
So it is over for you.
I don't really see. One of the things that we asked for when we requested the audit is we were told from day one by UDOT that if we didn't like what they were doing, we should sue them. And mounting a lawsuit is a monumental task. We actually consulted with lawyers, and they said, suing UDOT on the basis of technical merit would be difficult, and B, UDOT tends to change the playing field and makes it even more difficult to sue them. We can see right here, they had three different approaches to the maximum. So we realized that suing them wasn't feasible. We thought hopefully that the audit would come up with a solution. But one of the things that we asked for from the auditors was, or the legislative request, that there be some other option for citizens to actually be heard than filing a lawsuit. We had recommended that maybe some sort of adjudication board where we could actually take our concerns and have them addressed before something is done, like a wall built. UDOT, we complained to them. They ignored us. It's the fox guarding the chicken hen. So we were hoping that maybe a recommendation out of the audit would be maybe there needs to be another step where citizens can have their issues aired and addressed without a lawsuit and without actually waiting till after the wall is built.
So the state ombudsman can't do that because we do have one?
Apparently not. I don't know if they cover UDOT or just some other agencies for, land use and things like that.
Yeah. So you say you are going to put this behind you, move on with your life. I mean, what can you tell us that you learned out of this process? I mean, are there any takeaways for you?
You know, this I've been doing this for about a year and a half. And the takeaway is that I don't think, no matter what else we could have done, and I've thought of other things that maybe there were missed opportunities here and there, but we're really up against a state agency that basically can do whatever they want. It seemed to me, and my naivete is, you know, I have an engineering background. I looked at the numbers. They were pretty clear to me. And I thought, if I presented this to UDOT, that it would be logical that they would say, yeah, maybe there's something going on here. You know, at every opportunity they had, publicly they said, we don't care one way or the other whether we built this wall. We just need to meet our criteria. Well, we pretty clearly demonstrated that they weren't. And that they went from a wall, they turned to a berm wall. They were pretty fixed. They were pretty fixed that they were going to build this thing. And we suspected that maybe by the time they announced this to the Summit County residents back in April or May of June of 2017, they had already issued the contract to have the thing built. And therefore, they, A, felt they couldn't, or B, they didn't want to back out of that. So I'm not sure there's, you know, I've said, and I, to the folks that have supported, you know, Citizens Against the Wall, we didn't win this one, but I think we would be better prepared to deal with another issue that was troublesome to the residents of Summit County. So yeah, we did probably learn some things that maybe that would be appropriate in the future. I don't know that we've learned anything that would ever help us deal with UDOT again. I mean, and I think that's the thing that we were really trying to do, because there are going to be more noise walls. There could be more noise walls throughout Summit County. We have an interstate that runs right through the county, and there could be more walls in other locations throughout the state.
Oh, well, even maybe on 248, as we talk about expanding that to four lanes. Yeah.
Sure. So UDOT was pretty clear that they said, two other items that were in, that we made allegations on and were in the audit that were sort of, in my mind, kind of glossed over. One was the balloting. If UDOT had the, you know, from an audit that they had from a project up in Far West back in about, I think, 2015, they were told that they needed to interact with the citizens of the community better than they did in that example. So they actually came in and did these open houses, and everybody's going, well, isn't that wonderful? We can actually have a dialogue and interchange. UDOT basically said, we're doing this, but whatever you say doesn't matter. The only people we can listen to are the people that we're going to ballot. The policy says that they shall ballot non-benefited residents that are adjacent to the end of the wall. That's in their policy. It is, you know, I guess the language is a little open to interpretation. But UDOT went out of their way to figure out how to not let those additional residents vote. If they really cared about what the community thought, and there was an opportunity for other residents to have a say, why did they go out of their way to not let them do that? And our suspicion is because some of my colleagues on Citizens Against the Wall live in the community that was denied the right to vote. So again, UDOT made, you know, they could have allowed those people to vote if they really cared about input, but they didn't. The other issue that was the auditors basically cleared UDOT on responding to the GRAMA request that we made. A year ago, and the irony of why there's 1,600 feet of recreational, then 2,373, and then 3,200, another violation that we pointed out in our allegations was federal regulations require every state highway agency to have a written standard procedure on how they identify recreational areas. And obviously UDOT doesn't have that if they come up with three different numbers. One of the things that we asked in a year ago at a meeting, I mean, in July, a year and a half ago, the first meeting we had with some of the UDOT staff, and we presented our numbers, and they said, well, that your numbers don't apply because we have all this recreational land here. And we said, well, could you share with us how you determine that? What's the procedure for identifying between residential and recreational? We never got an answer from them. We finally had to ask that question in a GRAMA request, and we never got an answer to it through the GRAMA request either. One of the things when they came out with their berm wall summary in October, we asked for a copy of the full report so we could dig it into it a little more detail. They never gave that to us. We also asked for that through the GRAMA request. We did not get a response. So, yeah, UDOT spent a lot of time and money in responding to some of the stuff that we asked for, but it was only after we were continually denied that we started asking for more. And because we asked for more, they had to dig more, but they never really responded to the key ones that we asked for initially that would address clearly what we were after.
Yeah, I just got to ask, because you wrote an op-ed in the Park Record. I mean, you basically answered your own rhetorical question, you know, what can citizens do? I mean, you say nothing, but I mean, look what you've done. I mean, it hasn't been nothing. I mean, maybe it was all for nothing, but
Oh, yeah. I mean, I guess that was, I don't regret doing what I did. I think it was well-intended, and I think we still are correct. You know, UDOT never came back to us and said what we were claiming was wrong. The auditors didn't even mention anything about all our work to say that we were wrong. You know, and I, you know, the auditors, you know, they're a separate bunch. Supposedly they're unbiased and independent. I think when we spoke the last interview, when I found out they were doing, we asked the legislators authorized the audit September 18th. The auditors were finally assigned to do the audit in the middle of November. I called them to find out what was going on. They said they had just met with UDOT. They were getting all their information. They said they would meet with us after Thanksgiving. We didn't meet with them until the first week of January. There were two of them and four of us from, we've been up here in Jeremy. And when they came in and sat down, they said, well, we're just about ready to wrap up our report. And I was a little taken back because they hadn't even talked to us. When we sent in our allegations, we said we would be glad to share all of our documentation. So after the meeting, because we said some things, they said, well, we need to see documentation of that. We sent them a boatload of information. And about 2 weeks later, I called to follow up to see if they had any questions about what we had sent them. And if there was an opportunity, if they would like to meet again, I'd be glad to go down to their office. And they said, no, that's okay. We're done. We've finished the report. And they announced that they would be presenting it to the legislature on January 30th. So I was a little disappointed about that I don't think they went through our material as thoroughly. I mean, they call it a limited scope. Quite frankly, I think it was limited in depth as well as scope. What they did about the cost allowances clearly indicates to me they aren't familiar with the federal regulations, 23 CFR 772. If they tell UDOT to do something that would be in conflict or doesn't exist in that. So, yeah, we...
Okay, I need to leave it there, Tom. Thanks for your time this morning. KPCW News Time now, 8:47. Good morning. Well, this Sunday afternoon, the Sports Neurology Clinic presents a free education event titled Athlete Brain Health Beyond Concussion. In studio, I have Dr. Jeffrey Kuchar along with Carolyn Baxter from the Sports Neurology Clinic. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you.
Yeah, so Carolyn, maybe you can just tell us when and where and who this is for.
Absolutely. It's for anyone in the Park City and Salt Lake community involved in contact sports or parents and coaches dealing with athletes involved in contact sports. It's a free community event being held at the UOP Sunday, 2 p.m., and two-time Olympic gold medalist David Wise will be joining us to speak on his own experiences as an elite athlete and tending to his brain health from both a post-injury perspective and an injury prevention perspective.
Okay, so this, it's not at, it's at the UOP now?
It's at the UOP.
Okay, all right. And let's talk a little bit about, athlete brain health beyond concussion. I mean, of course, you see, I guess, Dr. Kuchar, lots of athletes suffer concussion. What, and just never get over it, or?
Well, we see a lot of patients from all types of sports, and concussions are things that are, used to not be worried about, people didn't care about it, we didn't talk about it. Then came this wave of awareness, and with the awareness came sort of misconceptions of what concussion is and what it isn't. Concussions themselves are injuries that resolve every time. There are potential long-term consequences from repetitive hits over time, but that is not concussion. And with this huge wave of awareness that came maybe 8 to 10 years ago and continues today, we have not caught up with the education part of it, and that's what this event is about, is to give everybody a good foundation of information of what concussion is and what it isn't.
Yeah, so what is the new science on it then?
Well, the first thing to say is not every time you take a hit, whether it's in a car accident or on the ski hill or in a football game, and you have symptoms, is that concussion. There are things you can also experience that produce symptoms that may look like concussion to some people, but it's some other mechanism altogether. And that's one of the things that we're trying to overcome, is this sort of trend of just throwing everything into this concussion basket without thinking about other possibilities. Other misconceptions that we're trying to correct is that concussions have long-term consequences. Like I said, they don't. And so the number of concussions is a very common question we get. My son or daughter has had 2 or 3, and they're not going to play the sport anymore because something bad is going to happen. That's just not true. And actually, we see a lot more negative effects from kids and adults not playing sports than we do from those types of head injuries that they typically get playing sports.
So what defines concussion then?
So concussion is a transient injury, so it's temporary, it goes away. The brain experiences force. It is a functional injury. Think of it as a software injury. So it is not a structural one. So it's the interruption of the brain's ability to do its job. And it is created really by a mismatch of energy available to the brain. And that corrects itself. It's self-correcting. So the typical time course of 7 to 10 days for concussion is what we typically see. Now, people can go on to have symptoms for other reasons. And that's called post-concussion syndrome. It's a different diagnosis altogether. And I would say one of the things that we see in our clinics here in Park City and Salt Lake City very, very commonly are people who have had symptoms for a month, 2 months, 6 months, or longer, and they're being treated like they are concussed still, meaning avoid this activity, avoid these symptoms, don't do this, don't do that. That management style will do nothing but continue to propagate those symptoms because post-concussion syndrome is a different diagnosis that needs to be treated actively.
So at what point, though, does a concussion become a traumatic brain injury, which is permanent, right?
Right. So a concussion is a type of traumatic brain injury. It's on the milder end of the spectrum, mildest end of the spectrum. So we would classify concussion, that temporary state of functional injury, that is a type of TBI that is different from if you have a car accident, actually lose brain cells and have a structural change to the brain. We refer to that as moderate or severe TBI that has other consequences altogether. And that's another thing that we have to be careful about is if you have a high-speed crash on a ski slope, for example, you may have a concussion, but you may have something worse too. You may have a bleeding event inside the skull. You may have some other injury. So we want to be careful that on either end, we're not sort of missing things that are more serious and we're not making concussion more dramatic than it needs to be.
Mm. So the brain does heal from concussion, but may not heal from some of the more severe injuries then?
Absolutely right. That is correct.
Yeah. So, what is it that you can do?
Well, the first thing we can do is get the diagnosis right. In this era of sort of hyper-awareness and protocols at the high school level and youth sport level, it is really, it's kind of tragic because what we've seen is medical providers have stopped thinking. So in other words, like I said before, any symptom after a hit is concussion. So that's thing one, is to get the diagnosis right. That's what we can do up front. So we want to see patients same day, next day, as soon as possible. Thing two is then to start treating the symptoms. And you can actually treat symptoms directly, either with different therapy approaches, medication sometimes if needed. But the biggest thing is the appropriate reintroduction of activity. So when to rest, when not to rest is probably the biggest important nuance to get right.
So you're working with the Speedy Foundation. Tell me about that partnership.
Well, I've been working with, first off, the ski team for, this is my eighth season. And through that relationship that I've been the neurologist for the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association, I got to know the Speedy Foundation folks well and have been, our program is very supportive of the mission of the Speedy Foundation and others regarding mental health in sports and out of sports and suicide and those important issues that we really need to focus on. So any opportunity we have to get in front of the public with them, we're going to take, because I think it's an incredibly important message.
But is there a connection then between mental health and brain injury?
Absolutely, and it's complex, like everything else in this area. The first relationship people would assume is there is that head injuries, brain injuries, create worse depression and problems down the road. And they can, but really only in the situation where you have repetitive hits over time, over the course of careers that, the vast majority of our patients and the public don't experience. The part that we see much more often is the transition from being an athlete to not, whether that's your last high school football game or you're done with your professional skiing career or, you just can't play your men's hockey league anymore. That transition is a difficult one. And that is a very crucial time for people to be aware of increasing depression and suicide risks in that situation. So, like I said, it's complex on both sides of the equation.
Yeah. As you talk about kind of sports and hits, I mean, we know that it's not necessarily impact as it is maybe just impact, what the brain and your skull? I mean, is that what you're talking about, a hit?
Well, so frankly, it's just the brain itself either moving quickly or stopping quickly. It doesn't really have to hit your skull inside if you're just traveling at a high rate of speed and the brain stops all of a sudden, which is also important to point out that you don't have to be hit in the head to have a brain injury or be concussed. You can be hit in the body, for example, and have your head whip around in a whiplash fashion like a lot of accidents. It's important to understand that you can have different mechanisms.
Okay, so how's the afternoon going to work? It starts again at the UOP at 2 o'clock if people are interested.
Yep, we're going to have Speedy Foundation up to discuss mental health. And just going back to your points earlier, Leslie, about the mental health piece and whether mental health is a factor after a concussion or TBI. And as Dr. Kutcher alluded to, of course it is. But we're also trying to change the landscape and show that you don't have to have an injury to then have these issues addressed. That something like mental health can be addressed on the front end as an athlete. You can work with a healthcare provider, a neurologist, to address those issues. Same thing with headache hygiene, sleep disorders, ADHD. These are all neurological issues that can impact an athlete's performance and their quality of life that unfortunately we don't see getting addressed right now until after they have an injury. Going back to the event though, we're going to have Speedy Foundation come up and chat about mental health. Dr. Kutcher and I are going to speak about athlete brain health beyond concussion, go more in depth onto some of the topics we've discussed this morning. And then David Wise is going to come up, share his perspective, and he's also willing to hang out and sign some autographs after, too. So we're very fortunate and appreciative to have him on board.
Okay. And David being somebody who's suffered concussions repeatedly, or?
We'll let him speak to that at our event. But he's somebody who is very aware of his own brain health and athlete brain health and supports the messages that we're trying to get across.
Yeah, hasn't kept him out of the half pipe.
No, it
sure hasn't.
No.
Yeah, okay. Again, the Sports Neurology Clinic, you guys are located here in Park City?
Yes, we are. We have a clinic in Pine Brook, and we're also seeing patients down in Sandy and Salt Lake.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
If you want more information, feel free to check out our website, www.thesportsneurologyclinic.com, or give our clinic number a call, 385-246-5971.
Okay. Carolyn and Dr. Kutcher, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're welcome, Leslie. Thank you.